Okay, moving along. Agenda item 18, Central Coast Groundwater Coalition update.
Item 18 is an information item to update board members on the status of the Central Coast Groundwater Coalition. Hector Hernandez, our lead staff person for groundwater monitoring for the Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program, will provide some brief remarks on the status of the cooperative groundwater monitoring, followed by Perry Clausen, executive director of the Central Coast Groundwater Coalition, who will make a presentation to the board regarding the coalition's efforts to conduct groundwater monitoring in compliance with the agricultural order. Hector.
Good afternoon, Chairman Young and members of the board. My name is Hector Hernandez, staff engineer with the Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program. The focus of item 18 is the Central Coast Groundwater Coalition, which is the largest cooperative groundwater monitoring program in the Central Coast region, and whose primary function is to fulfill groundwater monitoring requirements in the Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program of the Central Coast Water Board. As you all know, on November 1st, 2013, the Groundwater Coalition, submitted a revised work plan to the Water Board to address the new requirements of the State Board Order. In addition, the coalition also submitted a new work plan to add members and groundwater monitoring in the southern counties, namely San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara, and Ventura counties. Staff is currently finalizing approval of these work plans and does not anticipate any issues. In addition, the coalition also submitted their final membership list to the Water Board on November 15th of this year. Staff continue to work closely with coalition staff and has scheduled monthly meetings to ensure effective communication and project efficacy. The most recent meeting was on November 21st, in King City. Perry Clausen, executive director of the Central Coast Groundwater Coalition, will make a presentation to the board on the status of implementation of the Cooperative Groundwater Monitoring Program. And with that, I'll leave the stage for Perry.
Thank you, Hector. Good afternoon, members of the board, Chairman Young. I'm going to have Steve Deverell, who is our hydrogeologist, and Abby Taylor, who is our secretary treasurer, also be part of this presentation. Once it is teed up, let me know. Yes, good. Slideshow. Okay, we'll get started here.
Perry?
Yes.
Over here. Could you introduce your hydrogeologist?
Yes, Steve Deverell. He's with HydroFocus, Inc., and Abby Taylor Silva is with the Central California Grower Shipper Association.
Thank you.
And Perry, your name and title again?
Perry Clausen. I'm executive director. The coalition. Okay, this slide is a synopsis of a whirlwind that started about 12 months ago. And as you heard in a couple of presentations and some meetings that we had with the board, when the option was developed to have a cooperative groundwater program, the grower shipper, farm bureaus, and other entities in Monterey County, San Benito, Santa Cruz County decided to put out a request for proposals for consultants to come help them develop this plan. Myself and Michael Johnson, MLJ, were hired to do that. They raised the funds to bring us on to write a groundwater plan that would be in compliance with your cooperative groundwater requirement. We spent the next 6 months, almost 7 months, revising, working with staff, developing a plan that was ultimately accepted by Ken Harris on July 11th. immediately after that meeting, we formed an organization to be the official anchor of this cooperative program, the Central Coast Groundwater Coalition. It was not called a cooperative because the state has many strict regulations for calling things cooperative, and even though you guys can use it for your programs, when you form a 501c5 and you call it a cooperative, you have a book about this thick that you have to follow. So we went to coalition, but it's still functionally the same organization. So in that period of time when we were formed, we went out and had the approved plan. We solicited membership in the northern counties, Monterey County, Santa Cruz, San Benito counties, and Santa Clara, and were able to gain 135 acres of membership in that period of time. And as you know, in the State Water Board meeting in September, they reopened the roles and the ability for the coalition to add to the South counties. We put an effort together very quickly for that and were able to add another 65,000 acres of members in those southern counties. We then, after that process was finished, began sampling wells based on the plan that we submitted and was approved in July. And as of yesterday, we've almost passed 200 groundwater wells that have been monitored. That's just a little bit of an overview, but I would suggest to you that to go from where we were a year ago to where we are now is quite an accomplishment for the agriculture group. And I would say, as a farmer in the Central Valley, I really enjoy working with farmers, especially the ones on this board. These people are action-oriented. They want to plan. They want to move forward. And this is not a group that is going to be hesitating to move forward when they have a direction. So we are in the process applying for a 501c5 public benefit corporation with the IRS. That's a time-consuming process, but we are doing that. We have a mission to fulfill the groundwater cooperative requirements in your irrigated lands program. The organization has hired myself as the executive director. We seated our board, our first board, on the 5th of August, adopted bylaws. We also have officers and an executive committee, and then we also hired Grower Shipper to be our administrative organization, kind of our home base there in Salinas. This is our board of directors that you see here listed. Tim Burrell is our chairman. He is from Blanco Farms, one of the farms with Nunes Company. He's been in the program here since 2004 when you adopted your irrigated lands program on the surface water, of course. Abby was nominated and elected as our secretary treasurer. And then you see represented here farming groups that are all range of sizes, veg crops, strawberries, vineyards. We also recently added two board members. Randy, I'm sorry, didn't have his affiliation with his ranch down south. Claire Weinman has been added as well as the representative for a board member for the San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara counties. So this is our total acreage to date that has joined and committed to being in the coalition. As you see, we have 559 members, a total of 300 parcels, 3325, and we call parcels the assessor's parcel number. Farms, the ranch names, which are used in designations for surface water as well, are multiples of that. We, though, are based on APNs, and we've made it a little more complicated in that the APNs are not typically how growers see their farms. They see them as ranches and have different names. But anyway, the point being is that we have thousands of parcels that are involved in this, and you see the grand total of the acreage. We do have a sliver of growers in Ventura County over in the Carpinteria area, not a large participation, but, of course, that's the very southern end of your area. And I won't leave this very long, but just see the distribution of counties that have joined the coalition. By far, Monterey County is the largest, followed by Santa Barbara County with the two main vegetable growing and vineyard growing areas. So this is where we take our totals from. Our member lists have been submitted. We had two submissions. One was for the northern counties, which had the members at that time, and then, of course, very recently on November 15th, submitted the membership for the southern counties. So we are informing this group and in taking on these responsibilities, we are going to be implementing this program. One of the parts of our plan that I really didn't want to put in, but it was insisted, was what's going to happen if this program falls through? And you'll see that if you ever read the plan. If we don't follow through with our commitments, we are committed to making sure that whatever is done that we have committed to will be performed and completed. We are already started our outreach to members. We've developed a website, which you can see the HTTP up on the board there. We're going to be providing very frequent updates to our members through a newsletter, one of which we've done already, and we are beginning to plan our what we're going to call annual meetings or member meetings in February to, again, give growers an idea of what we have accomplished and what we plan to be doing. And we will be continuing to coordinate with regional board staff. As Hector mentioned, we've had two meetings with board staff. I think they've been very productive. I think we just want to understand that there's so many things when you start a new program you cannot possibly anticipate, that now that we're up and running, we're seeing, and so far it's worked out very well to sit down and just talk through these things, not in a forum with 3 minutes, but where we take 2 or 3 hours and spend very detailed conversations with our staff, with a couple of our board members, our consultants, with regional board staff, and we've been privileged to have Ken be able to carve out time to come to those two, so we really appreciate that. And we have one scheduled for January as well. Now, I'm not going to go into the details of our groundwater monitoring plan. At this point, I'm going to let Steve do most of that. But just as an overview of the approach that we took for the northern counties, because it's such a large area, we split it into three phases. The first phase, we've sampled 70 domestic wells. Steve will go through that information in Salinas and Lockwood Valleys. We still have some follow-up that we're going to be doing for wells that we didn't sample. Phase two will be Pajaro Valley. We will have it finished by June, but we anticipate being in the field with them in January. Gilroy Hollister is a little farther behind that, but we're trying to get ahead of these deadlines so that just because of the difficulty it is getting on site, getting these wells sampled, we're just going to continue to try to be ahead of schedule and, of course, meet these deadlines for the reports that we promised. Just briefly, a couple of maps that you've seen before. This is what we're calling the northern region with the main agricultural areas. This is the distribution of our member parcels. And as I mentioned, Salinas Valley is the best so far. And I only have these for the north. We just turned in the south list, so we haven't done this for the south counties. But as you see there, we have the majority of irrigated properties in the Salinas Valley. This is a Santa Cruz County with, you can see that there at the bottom, the edge of the county, the Pajaro and the Pajaro Valley and some of those upper farming areas, again, very well represented. San Bernardino County, a little bit less than I would have hoped for, but I'm finding out now, learning the agriculture area, there's a lot of unirrigated cropland in this area. That's been in pasture for years. They have water supply problems. That's part of the reason. We obviously have some work to do if we want to add members, if the membership's opened again. And then Santa Clara County, that's mostly farmed there south of Morgan Hill. So we've got the majority of growers in that area as well. Now, the southern region, all that I'm going to show you today on that, from a mapping standpoint, is the major farming areas where we have participation. Notwithstanding Coyama Valley, the carrot growers decided they wanted to go individual over there and didn't want to join the cooperative. Of course, that was their choice. But the Santa Maria Valley, Santa Ynez Valley, we have very good partner participation. In fact, I was out with a crew yesterday in some of these vineyards and farmland that's in Santa Ynez over by Solvang, and I think I want a job down there working in those farms. Those are some beautiful operations. Okay, so here's just an overview of our deliverables that we have for the South Counties. We've got landowner and grower list that went in on the 15th. We're going to have the list of wells sampled here in January 15th. And I might mention that when we opened, or when the membership to the South was opened, we added additional dues and offered to pay or to perform their individual monitoring for those landowners in the South as kind of a motivation to join. And Steve will give you an update on how many we've gone through already, which is in the hundreds. Then we'll be giving a list of wells that we'll be sampling for our characterization that's in the plan that's being considered right now. Because that's a little bit obviously different from the individual well monitoring. It's the characterization of the aquifers that we'll be doing in the north and in the south. And then we expect to be completed with all the sampling in the southern region by the end of December, about a year from now. But again, we've got made tremendous headway in sampling those areas already. So I'm going to hand it over to Steve. I'll be come back and talk to you a little bit of how we're responding to the exceedances that we found already. And we'll take questions at the end.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Appreciate the opportunity to talk to you a little bit today. I'm going to just briefly describe where we've been and where we're going with the groundwater monitoring. So our real objectives here are not only to characterize the domestic supply groundwater quality from a spatial variability standpoint and the temporal variability, but also try to look at the factors that are affecting concentrations. So we've done a little bit of extra in that regard. Just want to talk a little bit about the planning, what we did to kind of go into this. We had a long or fairly long time of contacting growers by email, letter, or phone call. We scheduled well site visits prior to actually sampling wells, so we knew what we were looking at, what kind of hookups we would have to have, and that kind of stuff. And then created well information sheets for each sampling team so they would know where they were going and who to contact and what the wells actually looked like when they got there. As Perry mentioned, our first sampling endeavor was in the Salinas Valley. We sampled 76 wells during the week of October 21st. For all the sites, we sampled the MRP constituents, the total dissolved solids, major ions that you see listed there, nitrate. And then we also sampled, kind of in the vein of this characterization process and understanding processes, we sampled took samples from all the wells for stable isotopes of water to give us an idea of what the source of the water is, and nitrogen and oxygen isotopes of nitrate, which will help us also understand the source of the nitrate that we're looking at. For wells where we knew the depth and were generally shallow wells within 250 feet, we also collected samples for pharmaceuticals, which are to serve as an indication of wastewater that may be in the water. And then for several of the wells, actually about 20 wells, we collected noble gases, tritium, chlorofluorocarbons to estimate year of recharge. So with these different constituents, we hope to have a better idea of what the time frame is in terms of when this water actually recharged and where the nitrogen came from. We had two basic types of wells encountered, although within each of these categories we had a number of different types of hookups. I'll just show you a few pictures here. This is a typical domestic well. This is our This is our typical hookup where we just hooked to a spigot and went through our lines coming from the well into a flow through chamber sitting on the table there and then into our instrumentation to record pH, conductivity, dissolved oxygen, and such. This is more of a irrigation / domestic wells. Many of the irrigation wells have been converted to domestic wells or have a joint use, and so this is one of our crews sampling at one of those sites where we have a large pump. And then this is some of our specialty sampling nitrogen isotopes. This is our collection for the noble gases and chlorofluorocarbons and tritium, helium, and this is the apparatus we actually collect the sample in. This is the results of that sampling during the week of October 21st. We exceeded the nitrate MCL in 32 of those wells for 80%. Two of those wells were within 80% of the MCL, and then the rest of them were less than 80% of the MCL. Concentrations range from less than detect to over 600 milligrams per liter. So the next steps are perform additional sampling. We have about additional 70 wells to canvas and sample there. We'll take that data and evaluate it in conjunction with other data to look at the distribution and then ascertain the need for additional sampling. This week, we're out in the southern counties. As Perry mentioned, we're doing individual sampling for growers in this area. We have four crews out there sampling wells. There'll be about 180 wells that are sampled this week out there. There are about 230 wells to sample, so this will go on for part of December and probably finish by the end of the year or early January. Mm-hmm. So I'll turn it back over to Perry just for a few minutes here. Thank you.
Okay, as you saw in the one slide, we had 32 of our wells that had exceedances, and try to not get ahead on me on this. It's a little bit confusing, but I'll walk you through this. So we have a well sampling occurs, and every one of the 76 wells, and I'm 76 or terrible with numbers, 76 wells were sampled. As soon as that crew left that farm, we sent letters to all 76 of those individuals as in what we called a pre-notification letter. Said a couple of things in the letter. We finished sampling. Here's what's going to happen. If we have an exceedance of the drinking water standard in that well, we are going to notify you by FedEx within 2 days of finding those results. If the water is between 80%, if it's 80% of the MCL, then we will notify you by email or by regular mail of that situation and the potential that we will be going back to resample that well in the year. And that, of course, comes out of the State Board ruling on sampling of domestic wells. So this, if that pre-notification also told them if the sample was below the drinking water standard, below the 80%, then we'd be notifying them by regular mail. So what we also did, oops, I hit the, let's do this again. We uploaded the field data of the sample wells to GeoTracker, which was, it's I believe, goes to the regulatory side. And then once that data came back from the lab, we had staff spend a couple days reviewing it for QA/QC because we had to make sure that there was proper chain of custody and all the QA practices that need to be done. So that was done, and once those results were finalized, the lab uploaded the data to the regulatory side of GeoTracker, and that you see over here. Now, when a member is notified to be above the drinking water standard, as I mentioned, he gets a FedEx letter. Also in that letter, he's going to have, and here's our communications to both the landlord and to the resident. We included a template letter that member could change, put his name on, that notified them of the levels of water, nitrates in the water. We also included in that mailing a circular that the regional board staff developed on nitrates and the hazards of drinking nitrate contaminated water. So that information was in there, as well as those two template letters that we were asking them to send, one to the landlord if they were not the landlord, and then also to provide to the resident who was drinking that water. So they had pre-written letters. Our lawyers looked them over, so they were official letters that went to all of them. And we also sent the residents letter in Spanish, so they could request from us an electronic version where they could put their name on the top and have their signature and such. So that would give them the opportunity. In that letter, we also included a website from the other organization that I work for, CURES. We were able to compile information on sources of replacement water, be it bottled water, reverse osmosis, and help me with the other one. Ion exchange. So that kind of a review of those technologies and then a list of the companies in the Central Coast, primarily in Monterey County, that provide the services of those replacement water sources. So that information has been provided to all of the members whose wells had exceedances of the drinking water standard. Those went out the day before Thanksgiving, that's just how the timing went, and we started to get calls earlier this week from some of those landowners asking for clarification. Most of them were pretty reasonable about the questions that they were asking. So that is pretty much a summary of the approach that we're taking. Of course, that last box there, the exceedances, this notification will also be given to regional board. Going forward, we're going to be completing our new member individual monitoring requirements in the groundwater plans. We've also asked each one of our members who had an exceedance to tell us in a period of time, or we told them we are going to be contacting you to see what have you done to correct that drinking water problem. It's not mandatory, we explained in the letter, it's not a requirement, but we want to know what they are doing to replace that information. We will be providing that to regional board in a summary format. We think it's inappropriate to wait a week or two and give them some time to think about what they're going to be, how they're going to be handling this water that's above the drinking water standards. We also plan to hold some member meetings in late February to give growers an update on our activities, and then we plan to continue fulfilling the tasks that we've committed to in our overview plan. So that's an overall look at what our organization is doing. I've got Abby up here. We didn't give her the microphone, but she's one of our officers, so she's available, and Steve and myself to answer any questions.
Great presentation. Abby, do you want to add anything?
And only that, I mean, I feel that the members are, we have exceeded our expectations on membership, which is great, and I think the growers have really come together. Just anecdotally, I know that a lot of our members are very interested in this program. They're very excited to see the results of the isotope testing and all of that and the characterization, and I think that was a main driver for a lot of them to join, so they're looking forward to our first report.
And I would say, too, that many of our members knew I know I come from the Central Valley and are somewhat familiar with our program. They have been very appreciative of the fact that we formed this coalition. And we, going into this, we had no idea who was going to join, if anyone was going to join. And to get roughly 200,000 acres, about half of irrigated land, in a matter of 8 months, I think has been good.
There was a time when there were only 13,000. I think we were 10 days out. We were a little nervous,
yeah.
But then it all came together.
That's what deadlines are for. In both instances, we had a lot of mail the day before the deadline or the day of.
Well, it'd be interesting to see what the data shows in terms of the isotope information, where water is coming from, how old it is, things like that. It'll be really fascinating.
Yes, and we're focusing right now on collecting the data, of course, and Steve's got a lot of work in front of him in the coming months to do that identification. The other thing he didn't mention, he did in other times, is there's a pretty significant amount of existing data out there. The individual programs, as well as USGS and Steve, you might want to mention, that's going to go into our characterization.
Good. Okay, board questions. Mr. Jordan.
That was a great presentation, but I think really my question is for staff, and the question is that in the notification process, we then are seeding what we would normally do for notification. We are seeding that process to the coalition, right?
Yes, that's correct. We've provided them with all of our notification letters, copies, templates.
So if the government doesn't do their job, somebody knows who to complain to and who to seek redress against. And if that were to happen with a coalition over a period of time and somebody was to make a case for damages, what does this look like? It's really a group with no assets. So how do we ensure that they're actually doing what we would do with the same oversight?
As far as the notifications,
yeah,
is what you're mentioning.
So the presentation. I'm not questioning the presentation. The presentation just said we do the same. They do the same thing that we do. We ensure that we notify both the owner and give an opportunity to the users. They ask for a response from the owner as to what steps they're taking, but year into this and life hits or economics hits and maybe it's not being done that well and somebody that should have been notified isn't being notified and continues to use that water, what's the recourse then?
Well,
I know what the recourse would be if it was a state agency that wasn't doing it and fell down on the job. Somebody would say, well, that's great. Uncle Sam's going to get a notice from me. But what's the recourse in this situation?
That's a good question, and I might ask Jessica to respond to that. But let me first say that the state board order actually instructs the water board to do the notifications and to coordinate with the third parties. So what we're doing is in our approval of their work plan, we are requiring them on behalf of their members to conduct that notification. So I believe, and Jessica can correct me if I'm wrong, if the notifications don't happen, the recourse is on the individuals who are required to comply with that requirement. Is that correct?
Before Jessica answers, we do require them to keep their records.
Right.
And so we can go over any time and look through there to ensure that those letters are going out and that they've gotten the notification back. So we're looking over their shoulder the
mm-hmm.
whole time.
Okay.
And there was a bit of checks and balances in that because all of ours are certified mail. So we know the grower has to sign that they received the letter, which I would say is kind of an above and beyond step, so that we know that they got it and had it within 10 days from there to give the notice to their residents. So they're, and we're communicating with that.
Okay,
and then they're required to inform us they've completed the notification.
Okay.
Part of the... this is a good example of where these monthly meetings are working through these kind of technical problems where we sit down with them and we go over a variety of issues and I mean, and talk about those kind of things and make sure they get resolved.
And I was just going to put on my other hat and say, just as you use the NASA and JPL analogy for some of the things we attempt to do and then compensate on the fly, I know we've said repeatedly over the past as we've started this the ag waiver process and gone through it that we're not going to sit there with a club over your head, and we're not enforcement based. That as long as we can lure you, prod you, or help you get to a spot, we won't jump on you. And I think the same we share the same burden in dealing with an organization like this. It's Mike. I'm stealing Mike's little whisper. You've got almost half the acreage, almost in our region, and that's great. And you will also have some NASA moments where you're out at flight and something comes along and maybe that moment will be a non-compliant moment, but it wasn't anticipated, and we should be expected to give the same consideration to that dynamic as others are to the dynamic of us going through that learning curve. So.
Yeah, and we're facing that right now. We had somebody call that was sick in the hospital for 2 months, and he finally got home, read through all his mail, and he said, did I miss the deadline to join the coalition? Well, yeah, you did by about a month. So I'm not sure on those, and we need to talk to staff. How do we deal with these things where somebody has honestly made a mistake? We also had Abby's got a big office. One of the entries got put into somebody's inbox, and it got shuffled around. And so, yeah, that's almost on a daily occurrence here lately, but yeah, I think that working with staff, we're going to be able to get through those.
Yeah, so that is a good example where we said we understand. Fine, go ahead and enroll the individual. I would say the level of communication and cooperation between the coalition and the staff is excellent. I'll leave it at that. And Perry's too modest. And if you don't know Perry's background, he not only is a farmer, but he also is executive director of the largest coalition in the Central Valley. He does that, and he's a good son and takes care of his elderly mother when needed. And so how he finds all the time to do everything he does, I don't know.
Thank you, Ken.
Okay, Dr. Hunter.
Thank you. And I echo the sentiments of seeing such good progress, and we appreciate the detail in your report. It really helps to paint a map for us to see where it's headed, and especially to understand where there may be glitches, you know, that you are already working on, you've already identified, et cetera. I just have a question, and this may be just conforming to existing practices, but I noticed that, and you mentioned that you notify the operator within 24 hours, so you have a FedEx notice that goes out. So, and then you provide not only notification to them, but then you assist them by providing them with this template letter. So that's an efficient and way of facilitating notifying the user. But the question I have is 10 days then for the user to get notified. Does that conform with existing practice, say under public health rules, or where does that 10? Because to me it would seem like, okay, 48 hours, maybe 72 hours. Yeah. People are drinking contaminated water. So
that conforms with the State Water Board's final order. And I believe, in Angela, that it used to be 30 days from when they got the notification from the regional board. So both we and you are updating yours to a 10-day notification. So it's based on the state order.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Johnston, and then Russ.
Since over here the North 40, you don't.
Go ahead. No. Let Mr. Jeffries.
No, let Mr.
Okay.
You have seniority, Russ. Okay, a couple of different things. First of all, we had anticipated getting this presentation in advance so we could prepare a little better. We did not get anything before today. Will there be a presentation or the slideshow or whatever made available to us?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, certainly. I apologize for that. It was one of those NASA moments the last 3 days, so I don't know. I'm not going to go into what was.
So that will be made
it.
Available to us, and that will be part of the public record of the
yes.
meeting as well?
Yes, in
okay.
fact.
Next. So your as the way I understand the presentation, you're relying on the, when you come up with a well that exceeds the MCL, you are providing materials to the farmers to do the notification to the landowner and to the users of the well. The coalition is not doing the notification to the users, correct?
No.
And it's going to the member. So it could be the landowner, or it's whoever the member of our organization
is. So it's going to the member, right. And then you're asking the member to check back with you and tell you, confirm that they've done the notification and tell you what measures they've taken?
We're planning to check in with them.
Okay, you're going to check in with them, and then you're going to provide that information to the board on a summary basis?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm trying to understand what that means. So if my question is, if someone has a drinking water, a domestic use well that exceeds the MCL, and you send them the materials and you check back with them a week later, and they say, well, we told the users of the well, we provided the materials to the users of the well, but it's up to them to deal with replacement water supply. That information is only coming back to the board on a summary basis, so we won't know which particular well that was. Is that correct?
That's correct. And Ken, I don't know if you want to weigh in on this. The requirements pretty much stop at the notification.
We get the raw data. We know which wells are exceeding the drinking water standard. So if you wanted, we could take that data and go to Salinas or wherever their headquarters are, and as I told Mr. Jordan, do an audit and check that data.
Yeah, I guess my question is, so we get the raw data. We know which wells will exceed the MCLs and which ones will be within 80% of it, but my understanding is that for the individual monitoring, the state board ordered all domestic wells monitored, okay, whether they're in the cooperative program or not. For the individual monitoring, we know, because we're doing the follow-up, whether that whoever the landowner or operator is providing treatment or replacement water. For the cooperative monitoring, we'll know how many of them are providing treatment or replacement water, but we won't know which ones unless we choose to go up to Salinas and pour through the records. Is that correct?
Well, and I think we've not really gone that far down the road. I think our members have been notified that if they would like to tell us that they're providing replacement water or doing something else and allow us to pass that information on to the regional board, that we would be happy to. And we've offered that in an effort to make things easier on everyone, so that you have that information. So if our members of our coalition give us that green light, then we would. Otherwise, yeah, perhaps if they don't, then it would be just as you would on an individual having to do that follow-up if they don't give us that.
So I agree. We haven't quite gotten that far, but I think if we had to, we could, if it didn't come back through the coalition, we could send a letter asking the landowners to provide us that information directly. If they haven't reported it to the coalition and we don't know, we could ask them directly whether or not they've provided replacement water or what type they've provided.
Yeah, I certainly want to see us, for every domestic well, which they're all being tested, I certainly want to see us getting access to the information as to verification that notifications have been made and also the knowledge of what measures are being taken to deal with it or are not being taken. I think, and then we can take it from there and decide what we want to do. But I think that information needs to come back to us. And the mechanism for doing that, as you said, we're adjusting on the fly, but it seems like that's an important piece that we would be remiss if we were not making part of the process.
Mr. Chairman, Angela, can you respond to the Mr. Johnson's comment that all domestic wells are being sampled?
So, and I'm trying to remember the state board order here in my head on the fly. However,
it's a kind of a tiered approach based on concentrations.
Right. So part of it, so not every, I guess the question, the answer is not every domestic well is sampled. It depends on what levels necessary for characterization, as well as the projection, mm-hmm. right?
That's so 50%
projection. Right. So if a domestic well is projected to be within 50% of the MCL, correct, then it would have to be sampled. So not everyone is sampled.
That said, our program is working as if we're sampling every well. I mean, we've reached out on every single well that's been enrolled in the program and have intent to sample. I think the only reason we wouldn't is if the characterization was so strong that we found that sampling an additional well was absolutely unnecessary. But we're acting as if we're sampling every well, in part because of that 50%. It's not going to be cost-effective or worth, very cost-effective, basically, if we go out and sample based on a 50% projection. So, I mean, Steve, I don't know if you have anything else.
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay. That's all I've got. Thank you.
Mr. Jeffries.
It's been so long, I forgot what I was going to ask. First of all, I'd just like to thank Perry and the group and for the progress that you've made so quickly. I think that you've really, really expedited the whole process, and I really appreciate that. And I also want to acknowledge Claire for her persistence on being included in this year and not have to wait for another year to get in the process. Have you had anybody drop out since they first enrolled?
Yes, we have.
You have?
We've had some that signed up without reading the instructions. Where they were, oh. We had one yesterday when Carpinteria gets city water. He said, well, how am I going to sample my well? I get city water. We said, you didn't need to be in the program. So
sure.
That's reasons like that. Not having a well on their property has been the primary reason. I'm trying to think, Abby, of other...
That's the primary. And we have been able to work with staff to be very clear about what the requirement is, and I think there was some confusion, just, again, not reading the entire application or the fact page. So it's a minor amount, though.
Right. Okay. How many people do you have working on this?
At any one given moment?
Well, how many people do you have involved in it totally?
One, two, three... 6, 10 probably,
yeah.
8 to 10.
Active,
but not full-time every day.
So we actually benefit from the fact that the infrastructure, and I hope you don't mind me telling them this, the infrastructure that he has developed for the Central Valley is being used here in terms of the same consultants, same database people. So this region is the beneficiary of work.
Well, it's obvious that it's not starting from ground zero, that you've got some, you know, ups on it from previous experience over in the valley. And I appreciate that very much for you bringing your expertise over here and helping us in this particular area as well.
Especially in July, it was really nice coming over here.
I can imagine coming from the valley in July over to the coast was very
really nice.
You worked for nothing at that time?
Yeah. Just for pay that me and lunches at Phil's.
I'm not going to ask. I think Mike and some of the others have asked the technical questions that I was going to ask, but I was just a little concerned about how many people that you have, how many people are dropped out, and of course those type of issues, I'm sure that they don't need, you know, I don't know if everybody read it before they signed it, you know, sometimes saying, what was that famous statement, pass it and then read it after you've passed it.
You know, seriously, I think we have more people want to get in now that they've heard about it and they've seen things going on. They're disappointed that they can't get in, and I think we need to think about how to add more members.
I agree. I think it's a good process. It's a good plan, and I think it's going to benefit the agriculture community. It's not only that, but it's going to benefit this region totally. I mean, our staff,
without a doubt.
This board, it's going to be a great tool in the future after you get the bugs out of it.
Right.
And after we shoot the rock up 3 or 4 times, we'll learn what programs to use and what not. And I want to thank you, Perry, for your expertise and willing to come over and head up this organization and to help us through this process. It's been a long process, as all of us know, but I think there's light at the end of the tunnel, and I want to thank all of you.
Well, one thing I'd say I'm encouraged is the growers are proactive here. They do not like to be painted with the fact that they are having workers or people drinking water that's not safe. And I hear that over and over again. So I think we have a willing group here that wants to see this problem handled.
I agree.
Are the growers in the Central Valley not as equally motivated?
We have 4,000 growers and 700,000 acres in the East San Joaquin Coalition. So that's one coalition out of seven. I'm one of seven. So they're motivated. The groundwater program is behind in the Central Valley. I mean, we're working about a year behind where you are with this. So I would say I wouldn't put that comparison. The individual monitoring, the domestic well monitoring, is not where it's at here in the Central Valley. Of course, they just appealed our WDR to the state board, and I'm wondering if there's going to be a repeat of what we heard in September.
So my final comment, Mr. Chair, is to Abby, and I want to thank her personally because I know she spent a lot of sleepless hours mulling this over. And her direction was to get this going, and I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
I would echo that. Abby's the driver.
Okay, so one additional comment.
I've been looking at your website here, and I would just note that under the Why Join tab and under the Join the Central Coast Groundwater Coalition tab, there's to read it, you would think you could still join. There's no mention of the deadline.
Yeah, good point. And we should update that.
They can join?
Thank you.
I'll be working that one.
Okay, so we have a few more questions. Jean-Pierre Wolf.
Oh, sorry.
Let's go ahead, Dr. Wolf.
A technical curiosity, quick question. This one is, I'll be very brief as always, Mr. Chair. Question is for Steve. Any ballpark dollar cost at a commercial lab to have a water aging test using radioisotope technology or performing a nitrate aging test?
Well, the nitrate...
Just a rough...
The tritium helium is actually quite expensive. It's like $1,500 a sample. So we've been very... kind of careful as to where we collect those samples. But we do have the other method, which is determination of chlorofluorocarbons, things like freon and such, that there's a good record of those in the atmosphere and can provide groundwater age as well. And that's quite a bit less expensive, like $200 a sample. So we're looking at those two methods. And between the two of them, we hope to have a reasonable cost for estimating some of these groundwater ages. The nitrogen isotopes are quite inexpensive. We do those through UC Davis, and it's less than $50 a sample, so we can do a lot of those. Pharmaceuticals are high. Those are $700, but we're not doing those everywhere. And, again, it's more kind of a check to see if there's wastewater and that's maybe a cause of the high nitrates in some places.
Thank you. I was asked that question by several groundwater pumpers in areas where their basin are declining and said, I wonder how old the water is that I'm pumping.
Mm-hmm.
So you gave me the answer. Thank you.
Bruce.
You're welcome.
A brief question. Is there, and then a brief comment, is there potential for any undetected pesticides or heavy metals in these wells that you're testing?
We're not currently sampling for heavy metals or pesticides in the groundwater. It's not part of the order and kind of beyond our scope at this point. We know that there are high arsenic in some places, but it's not part of the order right now.
So there's potential for harmful pollutants in the water that aren't being they wouldn't be detected.
There's that potential, yes.
Okay. My brief comment is that I've not been here long enough to know on a personal basis what's gone on the last 10, 20 years in this arena, but I've read through a lot of the records. So it seems to me that this what we've seen today's presentation and the progress you've made in the last 12 months is a sea change of collaboration and data forthcoming that just seems to be remarkable. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Dr. Hunter.
I think this question is for staff. Perry's comments about kind of the momentum of interest and kind of understanding what the program offers and the benefits that may come with being in the coalition. This came up before where we found that there was reticence initially and deadlines came and then more people started to voice their interest in becoming part of a collaborative. Is there any consideration at this point, given that we're just getting this rolling, of opening up those deadlines, or is there an annual cycle where new growers or operators can come into the program? What does that look like?
Angela Schroeder. So first I wanted to just echo your comment that there's renewed interest. I really want to commend the coalition because they take their administration outreach very seriously. It's very easy for us when we get questions from growers who are saying, what's the cooperative, what are the benefits, how do I join? I can just say, here's the numbers. And then they really have a very robust level of outreach. And what I think what's great also is that when those members come back to us, they're fully aware of what the responsibilities are and what the co-op is doing for them, which is really helpful for us because we don't spend our resources doing that. There isn't the membership opportunity is closed, and that's primarily because, as you recall, the individual monitoring requirements was only for the first year, right? There was just those two sampling periods, and then they're done. So all those growers who selected individual were required to comply, and in general, unless they haven't complied, are completed. Similarly, their requirements should be done by December of 2014. And then we'll reconsider for the next order how we want to move forward with the monitoring.
And we have confirmed with staff as well, though, if a new grower comes in, that they can enroll into our program. So if someone opens a new ENOI, they can still join.
Right, so farmers who are just starting to operate have that opportunity to choose.
Oh, okay. All right, that's good.
So not to freak everybody out, I mean, time flies when you're having fun, but we're looking only at 9 months before we start talking about the next, at least public sessions about the next order.
Okay, so when will all of your data be in? Is it, I guess the south part is lagging behind the northern part just because of the sequencing.
Not the final reports, no.
Final report, so no, final report being, is it next September?
No, it's March 2015,
yeah,
I believe.
Yeah.
The final reports.
I believe, though, for the south, because the south is there are two work plans, one for the north.
Okay.
Right.
One for the south, even though it's one coalition now.
Okay.
And I think you were allowed under the state board order additional time. Is that not right, Angela? Whether they take advantage of it or not.
Well, sampling has to be complete by December 1 of 2014.
A year from now.
Right. But I think the north sampling had to be done by September, right?
That's correct.
So yeah, there was a 3 months.
We're on schedule for that.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then the reporting goes out, I think, for 3 months past mm-hmm. those.
So two parts to your question. The data will be in September and December. So September north, December south. The reports, the analysis, and all that's in 2015, I believe, March 2015.
Mm-hmm. So I can anticipate having some staff presentation once all the data's in, but certainly maybe somewhere in between now and then, we could get another status report.
We can do that. We can schedule
maybe
some interim
kind of
staff.
Maybe mid-year or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Really appreciate it. Yeah. Should we take a break, everybody? We have two items left, 19 and then 6. So why don't we take a break, and then we'll come back 10 minutes or so. Yeah, about a quarter of, and we'll take on number 19.